What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina, who is of the internet everywhere on the internet. Michael, your coverage has been amazing here through the bubble, and I don't know if it started to hit you this weekend, but it feels like we're coming down the home stretch of sort of the first lap of the bubble. We've had a couple teams eliminated already. The Washington Wizards were first on Friday, followed by the New Orleans Pelicans and the Sacramento Kings on Sunday. Further cuts will be happening this week in advance of the Western Conference's play-in round, which is going to take place on Saturday and then Sunday if necessary. And from there, Michael, the long-awaited 2020 playoffs are going to grace us with their presence next Monday. I'm pretty excited about it. It's been crazy. Feels like time is flying down here. I can't believe, you know, some of these guys are already going to be packed up and jetting out of here as early as Friday. But I wanted to start with maybe with just a quick round of fact checks on some of our takes from the hiatus, because, you know, we got a few off during the four-month time period, and now we've had a couple of weeks of basketball to kind of review things. I think one of my strongest held takes, Michael, was the idea that, like, the basketball was going to be sloppy, that, you know, defense was probably going to have an advantage at the start. It was an argument in favor of a team like the Toronto Raptors, or, you know, sticking with a team like the LA Clippers. That's really not what we've seen so far here over the last, you know, 10 or 12 days, is it?
No. If you go to cleaningtheglass.com, a great statistical website, it actually points out that offense over the past, well, it says here 2 weeks, but for all intents and purposes, the last, since the bubble began, offensive rating, the average is 112.2. And before that, it was 110.8, which is a number that also includes the bubble. So it's even lower than that. So, yeah, we've seen, like, I'm kind of flabbergasted by this, to be honest with you. Like, players like Damian Lillard just, like, going off. I mean, he did miss those two free throws in the game against the Clippers, but then he just responds with 51. Like, we've seen just ridiculous performances by other superstars that we're going to mention and talk about later on. It's kind of surprising to me. It really is.
This is one where I do feel a little bit bad, not necessarily because of the original analysis, but because of the impact of the travel on it. Now, there's been a lot of talk about, hey, what's the gym like? Does it have good shooter lines? You know, and the players have said they like the lighting, they like the lack of crazy backdrop behind the hoop and all those kinds of things. But we did talk about things like how would travel, or a lack of travel rather, make things easier for writers. I've even written a story about how the referees are kind of liking the lack of travel, how their life is so much simpler. They just have to go back and forth to the gym all day long. That's all they do. It does stand to reason that, like, in a situation where you're, you know, trying to, you know, put together chemistry on offense, timing, you're trying to manage your energy and all these kinds of things that the NBA players have to deal with, and they're not having the wonky sleep patterns, they're not, you know, changing time zones multiple times during a series, they're just chilling in one spot. Maybe in hindsight it wasn't so difficult to ascertain that there actually would be, you know, an offensive explosion here out of the gate. I mean, I heard some stat it was up almost 10 points per game at some point. I don't know if that's still holding here to this point, but we've seen a number of, you know, big time scoring performances into the 130s, you know, not regularly, mm-hmm. but, you know, multiple times. And I'm inclined to attribute it to travel, and then also possibly to teams just not having their full complement of guys, you know. So maybe there's weaker links out there who can kind of get exposed a little bit more easily. But to me, I think the travel part's got to be a big deal, right?
Yeah, the travel for sure. I think that impacts and infuses a lot of this. I also think you bring up a really good point with, and I was going to get into this on one of our later questions coming up, but teams just not having the glut of their rosters available, or players who weren't able to participate in the training camp segment, who came back because of coronavirus or a different reason. That, you know, defense is all about communication. It's about continuity. It's about, I mean, you just look at teams like the Denver Nuggets, for example, the Los Angeles Lakers, their defense has been really good. But the Nuggets, the Clippers, just other teams that haven't quite, the Bucks, that we saw just be so much better on the defensive end before the shutdown that have kind of struggled because they either haven't had their players or they've had to adjust and kind of on the fly and get reaccommodated so quickly.
For sure. And this kind of leads me to another one that's related, which is the idea of, like, I was really worried, is there going to be too much basketball, right? You know, are they bringing in too many teams that are going to, you know, play these ugly games early on, potentially increase the risk for the contenders and put the entire program at stake? And I think what we've seen so far with still zero positive tests in the bubble, I mean, the health and safety protocols have worked flawlessly. I actually do have a real second thought on that one too, Michael, because we're sending home some really interesting teams this week, right? Whether it's, now the Pelicans are not the most interesting. They've been certainly disappointing. We're going to get to them later, but you do lose the Zion draw. You're potentially losing the Suns, who some people could argue is the single best story of the bubble. You know, they still have an uphill battle to get themselves into the playoff picture.
Wait, Ben, let me cut you off for 2 seconds, because I'm glad that you just mentioned the Suns, and I don't know if I'll have another opportunity to ask this question, but how difficult has it been for you to just watch all of this unfold? The best team in the bubble, your least favorite team?
Well, here's the thing. They're doing the victory lap so quickly. They have their first their first 5-game winning streak in like a decade. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we're getting the stories comparing Devin Booker to Kobe Bryant and all this stuff, and it's just like... You've got to be kidding me. I mean, and I understand the excitement. I really don't want to rain on their parade. I actually did local radio down in Phoenix last week, and they were already crowning the Suns as sweeping the Lakers in the first round of the playoffs. So I really like the passion and the excitement from them, but we do can we please just pump the brakes slightly? Just chill out a little bit. I mean, anyway, it's good to see their success. It's been a long time coming. And, you know, frankly, this whole season should have been better for them if not for the Ayton suspension. So it's nice that they're salvaging something out of it. But anyway, I guess my point here was the conventional wisdom maybe a month or two ago was this thing is too big. There's too many games. And now we're actually seeing some teams that, you know, I would actually be disappointed if Phoenix has to go home this week, right? I mean, they've played well enough to be a playoff team. I'd way rather watch Phoenix than Orlando or Brooklyn, and a similar deal with Memphis. It would be disappointing to watch Ja go home. I mean, I just feel like there's going to be some level of sadness in losing a few of these younger figures from the Western Conference. It's not like these guys are going to go win a title, but it does kind of feel like, wow, the party's over already. Like, we just started. We just got here, you know?
Yeah, that's really no different from every other season. Like, it's just the Eastern Conference, Western Conference thing, you know, where a team like the Nets is going to stick around. And I don't know about you, but I just have, like, there are some really interesting, you know, you could look at the Nets as like a Cinderella story. It's something I wrote in my column on Friday. And if you're missing March Madness or you missed March Madness, the Nets are probably like your team. But no one, like, in reality, no one wants to watch the Brooklyn Nets play basketball without Kyrie Irving or Kevin Durant.
I'm not missing college basketball that much, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. But, like, yeah, I agree with you where there's teams like that that will be around, and we're not going to get, you know, one of Portland. The Spurs are super fun. I'm really having a good time watching them. Phoenix, as we've mentioned. It's like, on one hand, us not getting to watch those teams in the playoffs is a huge bummer. And then on the other, it's like, I am very excited for the play-in tournament game.
So that's where I wanted to go with the next one, because that was another big topic of discussion of, like, oh, are they going to be able to generate some interest with this play-in, and, like, is it worth doing? And the NBA kind of, like, focused all their creativity on it. And I have a hard time remembering exactly what our take was. I feel like we were maybe sort of, oh, it's not really that big of a deal. Whoever wins is going to go get wiped out in the first round. I do think that the Western Conference play-in chase has kind of defined things here the last few days in the bubble, where it's like you're checking the standings, you're seeing who won. You know, Portland has a big comeback win, so that's a big deal. Knocking New Orleans out, you know, this win impacts this team, and all just the horse race stuff has actually really turned into quite the story, because you have a lot of just younger and hungry teams trying to extend their stays here, which you like to see. At the same time, though, I wonder, was this the opportunity, just given all the weird circumstances, for Adam Silver, who, like, in the past has said, you know, we only do 8 from the West and 8 from the East, you know, because of travel concerns, not tradition. In other words, he was like willing to experiment with this idea, not being tied to history. If there was no, you know, travel issues like during a playoff setup, well, here we are in Orlando. No travel issues. You could have anybody play anybody. I know at some point people were saying, well, let the favorites select their opponents, you know, for each round. That was an idea that was out there. I just wonder if they had come up with a scenario to just take the top 16 teams, regardless of conference, would that have actually made a more entertaining, more fun playoff bracket and actually have accomplished sort of what the play-in round was trying to accomplish, but like have done it in a totally better way that would have generated more TV revenue and just, you know, gotten more interest? I mean, what do you think? Like, did we get so fixated on this idea of the play-in round that we missed a better solution for such a strange year?
I think that you're right, where the first round of the playoffs probably would have been more interesting if the Bucks were playing the Suns or something instead of the Nets or the Wiz or whoever the eighth seed, Magic, whatever team, at the bottom of the East. But I have a real quick like nuts and bolts question for you about this, because for me, I really struggle to. I'm fascinated by the bottom of the West. I love that's you're spot on for saying that is what everyone should be paying attention to right now. I just can't even follow along with who is up and who is down. Like, who specifically has an advantage? Who is at a disadvantage? Who is most likely to make it? Who is not? Like, it's very confusing. And I'm just of the mind where I'm like, okay, whatever happens, like, I'm following along and I'm watching the games and everything. But I'm just kind of like, let's just get to the play-in game and just tell me who's in it. And I can't wait to watch, but I can't process like tiebreakers and all that mumbo jumbo. Like, are you in the same level with me? Are you more scientifically approaching this where you're able to really follow along in real time?
No, I mean, I'm not like a full Matt Moore with like the magic numbers memorized and tweeted out like every morning at 7:45 a.m. You know, I'm definitely not there. And I was in your exact same camp until probably Saturday. And then I started to realize like what I'm saying earlier, like Zion might leave. Oh no. Like I started panicking. And so I started digging into it a little bit more. And it's been a really fun race. I mean, it's complicated by this idea that it's not just about, you know, the typical race for the eighth seed. It's about that buffer for the ninth seed. And then it's complicated by the fact that not all these teams have played the same total number of games. So you're getting into these weird fractions where, like, yeah, you know, it, which, you know, ultimately is going to feel kind of unfair for whoever gets sent home, I'm sure. But yeah, I've been diving deeper and deeper into it, and it's been very rewarding. I mean, the Lillard performance, you know, on Sunday, like, you don't want to go overboard and call it like this heroic thing because it was happening against the Sixers, who were without Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. So it's like, congratulations, you lit up Alec Burks. That must feel fantastic. But at the same time, they're on a back-to-back. He had just completely tricked off a game against the Clippers with 2 missed free throws in the final second, so much so that Patrick Beverley is like heckling him from the sidelines. Paul George is talking trash, and that hardly ever happens. You just get this extended back and forth that carries over to Instagram, and it's the idea that like the Blazers can't get a stop to save their life, but as long as Lillard just keeps scoring 4-point plays, 3-pointers, dunks, like they'll be able to like pull this thing off. There was some real juice to it. You could actually, you know, where we were standing after the game, you could listen in on their post-game celebration, and Melo had cracked, I think, the top 15 for scoring. And you know, obviously, their playoff hopes were still alive. They still control their own destiny with 2 games to go. So these guys were loving life in what amounted to like a portable classroom that they've got set up, which didn't even have a ceiling, right? So it's just basically like temporary walls creating their locker room. And I mean, it's not even as nice as your high school locker room, I promise you that, where these guys were celebrating. And it's just a beautiful scene. You know, it's like these guys really want to be here. Not every team in this group, notably New Orleans, does want to be here. And, you know, they delivered. So I think that's fascinating. And I just, you know, worry for these kinds of teams like Phoenix or Portland, probably the two that want to be here the most, who have both, you know, made really strong cases to get to stay. One of those teams is going home. And I just think that's a little bit of a bummer. Is it worth completely throwing out your typical postseason format to save them? A lot of people would know, Michael, I would say yes. I would say that they should have done that, just taking the best 16. We would have a better playoffs. We would have more juice. Can you imagine Milwaukee versus Phoenix, right, instead of Milwaukee-Orlando? You're watching that one for sure, right?
But real quick, like, would you be focused that much on the games right now, though? Like, you're kind of delaying the satisfaction of the playoff series, but these games would be extra meaningless, don't you think? Like, do you even consider that?
Well, yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, but you would also, they would still have to crack into that top 16, right? So there's still some level of a race with the Orlandos and the Brooklyns of the world to, like, get their record up to the point where it needs to be. So it wouldn't be, you know, I would just trade the instant gratification of the play-in round for the delayed, longer gratification of better playoff series. And this is also just a hobby horse of mine. I've been riding it straight into the ground for the last 5 years, but I do think you should keep as many of the best teams in the playoffs for as long as possible.
At the end of the day, my idea that I definitely cribbed from someone else about how the top-seeded team should be able to draft who they play, I really think that that would be just terrific, right? Especially right now. Like, who are the Lakers even picking? Think about that. Like, they're not even really good right now. So it's like, they would clearly duck the Portland Trailblazers. I just think that that would be incredible, and it's undeniable. I will not let anyone argue with me on it.
They might even take a team like Utah, you know?
See, this is what I'm talking about. We could just be discussing who would the Lakers pick, and it would be, oh man, we're really missing an opportunity here.
That would be pretty wild. The last one on the take referendum from the bubble, Michael, would be my idea that the favorites were going to steamroll people because the underdogs would just kind of roll over in a playoff series. Mm-hmm. I believe you were on a different camp. I thought you might have said something along the lines of, hey, it could just be chaos down there, and it could just open mm-hmm. things up wide for, you know, a team like Houston or some of these other underdog teams. How are we feeling about that one? Obviously, we haven't seen it play out in a playoff round where the best teams are going really, really hard. And, you know, some of the Lakers, trials and tribulations the last couple of days could be because, you know, LeBron's not going 100% because the games don't matter. I'm just curious, are we leaning one way or the other on, like, is the bubble playing to the favorites or is the bubble playing to the chaos? Which do you think?
I honestly don't know the answer to this question. I did predict that it would be chaotic, but I also kind of thought that, like, what we've seen so far, as I outlined before, is just these teams are not complete. Like, the Clippers losing to the Nets, like, it's not a complete Clippers team. Now, that was obviously a crazy upset that I didn't predict or anything like that, but there's just other teams out there that, you know, like the Bucks with the Eric Bledsoe situation with them. You have the Pacers where, Sabonis goes home with the foot injury and you move TJ Warren to the four and all of a sudden the team just, like, takes on this completely different identity that's, like, we didn't see coming. So there's just all this weird stuff happening. I'm starting to think, though, that once playoff series happen and teams are able to make adjustments, that we're going to see a little bit more of the cream of the crop is kind of going to rise, except for the Lakers. Sorry, Lakers fans. But I do think that the better teams are, like, for the most part, looking like they are better than everybody else. And I think once we get a little bit more removed from, teams adding certain players and trying to incorporate them in, that those teams are going to look like the juggernauts that they were before the season was suspended.
I hear you. The team that I've actually made me rethink this isn't the Lakers, it's the Bucks, because they've had a couple games, like, come down to the wire and they've really struggled to execute on offense. Giannis has got his scoring here and there, but the kind of the team overall offense just hasn't been up to snuff. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of a little bit lost looking around, whose turn is it going to be? And, you know, Bud's had a couple questionable decisions. He took Lopez off the court at a key moment against the Mavericks, which just, you know, was kind of a head scratcher.
Is Brook Lopez, like, the third best player in the bubble?
Yeah, I was, you know, why not? I mean, he's been
incredible.
Balling. He's been balling, and he's getting his points in a lot of different ways, too. But I guess my concern with Milwaukee is just, like, when you're at home, first of all, you're probably going to get more calls, right? You're going to be able to ride that crowd momentum. They've got an awesome home court advantage. The underdog teams are going to be more scared to go into that building. I mean, it's not the craziest place, but, you know, there is a legit, you know, sensation when you're there. We saw what they did to Toronto in games one and two. They didn't play great in the Eastern Conference Finals last year, but they certainly took care of business, right? Now, down here, it's just a different vibe because they are trying to manufacture their own energy, all those kinds of slogans that we've started talking about. It's just not the same. They don't have that same level of control and inherent advantage in those late game situations. And for them, I mean, that has been a bugaboo in the past, right? You know, Giannis is not the off-the-dribble three-point shooter that everyone would hope for. He's not a Kawhi-level mid-range assassin. You know, so where do you go when the game slows down? I think that's an open question for them. And I think it's come through here in a couple of moments. And I just wonder, does the bubble chaos factor make those moments more likely? You know, does the lack of home court advantage actually, you know, just wind up working against the favorites more than I expected? I guess we'll see when they really ramp it up. And of course, they've managed Giannis's minutes very carefully here. Like, they're not chasing a single win in the bubble. So a lot of this analysis can go out the window if he just plays 40 minutes a night. But I guess that was one thing that I saw down here. It's like, oh, and these guys are missing that home cooking. You know, he's not getting to the line as much as I think he should, given some of the contact he's taking.
Oh, my God. Okay. Yeah. No, I'm not going with you there. I will say I do agree with you that home court is just like they're at the detriment there more than any other team, arguably, just because they had the best record. They would have had an opportunity to play any Game 7 in Milwaukee. That's a big advantage.
Michael, can't both things be true here, though? Can't he commit more fouls than he's getting called for? And can't he be fouled more than he's getting rewarded
You're
by the officials?
You're saying it all balances out in the end?
No, I'm outraged by the treatment of him. It's ridiculous. But I'm just saying, you know, you're freaking out when I made that statement. I think actually both things are true. I think that there's a number of situations where he is just such a physical player that maybe the referees do, you know, kind of like the overturn charges and stuff like that. Is that a superstar call? I mean, it's possible for sure, right? Is he fouling more than five or six times per game? It's very likely. He's a very physical player. But I also think on the other end, this guy takes a beating a lot and he can absorb it. In very Shaq-like ways. And so I'm not advocating that I want, you know, 35 extra whistles every night because then we'll be there for 4 hours every game. But I do think that, you know, he's getting the short end of the stick still, even if, you know, his detractors would make the same argument the other way.
Love Giannis. I do want to point out two things. One, you're like, he just doesn't have any late game moves. Like, it's the dribble, put his head down, dribble, spin move when the floor is spread that is just completely unguardable. And then if you really pack the paint, he's going to kick out to three-point shooters, obviously. But as we've seen in these crunch times, like, Giannis is pretty one-dimensional offensively, and that's going to continue regardless of where the games are being played as you get against different competition. The second thing I just want to say real quick is that Giannis, and I've been kind of pointing this out because it's so bizarre to me, but two more air balls from the free throw line the other night against Dallas in a game that was very close, and if you, you know, at least gave the ball a chance to go in by having it the arc be above the front of the rim, like maybe you win that game. So I just wanted to point those out there for you.
Shameless trolling. Actually, Zion had one too.
I know, I saw. Yeah,
it was pretty rough as well. You know, I think it's actually just the air circulation machines here down here in Disney World, Michael. They've got the super high powered filtration. It just kind of knocks the ball off course. It could happen to anyone. I'm going to save that clip of what you just said, that ridiculous slander against Giannis's name. And when he's holding up that Larry O'Brien trophy in an empty gymnasium and I'm the only person there to document it because everybody else has gone home, I will make sure to play that clip back to you. It's going to be fantastic. All right, let's actually hop to the other side of that game on Friday night. You know, sometimes these Friday night games get lost by us, Michael, because, you know, we put our episode out on Friday and then by the time, you know, we come back around on Monday, the news cycle has already changed. I think we need to stop and pause and just do some real, like, Luka Doncic gushing here. I mean, I don't know if you watched that game Friday night or caught the highlights. That was one of the most ridiculous performances I've seen in person this year, right near the top. It was the kind of game where, had that happened in Dallas, I'm pretty convinced fans would have been taking their clothes off in excitement. Like, I think it was one of those where you're just like ripping your shirt off because you can't believe it. Just going absolutely haywire. We got a question from Brandon in LA, and he's one of our favorite hot take artists. He always loves to bring the heat. He writes, "What the bleep is wrong with you guys?" And I mean all of you guys in the media. How could you make James Harden one of the three finalists for NBA MVP? Harden isn't even the best player in Texas. he might not even be the best player on his own team. Westbrook has been Houston's best player since January, and that's when the Rockets began to turn their season around and really look like contenders. The best player in the state of Texas is clearly Luka Doncic, whom you guys snubbed. So he's blaming us. I don't think either one of us voted, Michael, but he's blaming us for the top three MVP balloting that that came down last week. It's Giannis, LeBron, and Harden are the three finalists for MVP. I mean, Doncic is fourth or fifth, I think, on my ballot. I would really have to dig into it, but he's certainly a top five candidate to me. So I don't know if that's like this major snubbing that Brandon's talking about, but just talk to me about what you saw in that Milwaukee game, and then we can dig into the Harden comparison here in a minute. But what was your takeaway from watching just that explosion on Friday night?
It's like breathless to watch. I did watch the whole game. To do what he did, just some of the passes. I know the between the legs pocket pass to Maxi Kleber in crunch time with Giannis as the screenage defender was like, that's the one that's kind of getting all the attention. That might have been like the fourth or fifth most impressive pass that he made that night. Like, it was one of the best passing displays I've seen a player make in several years. And I just don't even know what you can say about him. Like, the footwork, the craftiness, the total balance, the total command of his own body. He just dictates everything when the Dallas Mavericks are on offense in a way that very few players in our lifetimes are able to. And I think like one of the first thoughts that I had after that game ended was that Bagley over Luka is the worst draft pick of my entire life.
It's a great take. It's a really, really good take, especially because you had the opportunity, like somebody else had already blown it, right? Like with the Ayton pick. So it's like, okay, here it comes to you. So it's not like it's one versus two, it's two versus three. It does up the terribleness of that call. What I think about when I watch Luka now, it's kind of like he's a lion tamer, but the basketball is his lion. Like, you know, have you ever seen those like weirdos who like live with lions for like 30 or 40 years and they just start to like develop this psychological connection where they can kind of read each other's mind and, you know, a little finger snap here or there and just the lion will do whatever the guy wants? I feel like that's basically Luka with the basketball. Like before the game, he shot a half court heave where the ball basically hit the ceiling of the building because he shot it like 45 feet up in the air and it just rattled in perfectly from half court, right?
Can I really quickly just plug something off of what you just said?
Oh, you have an article coming out about lion tamers?
No, I wish.
Check for it on GQ. The top seven sexiest lion tamers with NBA nicknames.
We're going to have to cut this so that I can steal that idea. But I interviewed Tim Hardaway Jr. On Friday, right before the game, actually. And we talked about an outfit that he was wearing primarily. But I asked him about Luka. And he said, like, the most incredible thing about Luka is every time he steps into the practice gym, he has to hit, like, he shows up early and he has to hit either a half court shot or a full court shot, or, you know, down in the bubble, there's like the courts are stacked kind of opposite one another. So you can have two courts, the length of two courts, basically. And Luka will try to shoot it from one end all the way to the other. And he like doesn't stop until he makes them. So he's just like on a completely different planet, I think, at like solar system, galaxy. Like, I don't even know how to judge this person. He is
the basketball
ridiculous.
Is like a part of his body. I mean, you probably had guys in high school, like the athletes would like carry the football around. I mean, we had a quarterback at Beaverton, Taylor Barton, who wound up going on to a pretty successful career, but he would carry the football around with him everywhere he went. You know, he always wanted to have it with him. You hear about guys like sleeping with the basketball. Like, I feel like Luka has done that with his entire life. It feels like the basketball is an appendage. He will do the little soccer headers every once in a while. He'll soccer juggle the ball with his feet regularly during games. You know, the different, you know, speeds that he can put on his passes, right? He has every speed. Like, you know, people talk about change of direction, change of tempo, you know, when you're dribbling the basketball. Like, he can do that with his passes. Now, look, there's a number of turnovers along the way. He definitely takes unnecessary risks, and his decision-making always isn't always the best. But when he really gets himself into that state where he was like kind of like worked up and completely locked in, and the whole game is just like unfolding in front of him, it's pretty ridiculous. You know, it's like definitely Magic Johnson, LeBron James level control and orchestration. And, you know, is he going to be able to do that every single night? Question mark, for sure. But you know, can he reach those kind of peak crazy Hall of Famer type levels? For sure. And I couldn't even believe Coach Bud, who basically hates ever giving a soundbite. I mean, that's like his least favorite thing to do in the world. And he was asked, like, who does Luka in year two like remind you of from an impact standpoint? And he's like, basically no guard ever. And the only name he could come up with was Tim Duncan. He's like, look, they're obviously different players, different sizes, you know, different positions and everything else. But
yep.
That was the first name that came to mind when he's talking about Luka and basically age 21 in year two. That was pretty wild, man. That was not something that I expected to hear at like 1 a.m. on a Friday night. It took me a while to calm down after that.
Yeah, that comment was absurd. Rick Carlisle, his comments have been... I mean, there's really nothing more that Rick Carlisle can even say about Luka. But one of the things that I think about often, going back real quick to like when two teams passed on him, and I guess you could say three because Atlanta traded him for Trae Young, is the criticism that he would not have, like his ceiling was not as high as other prospects, and that he would not be able to develop certain parts of his game because of limited athleticism. It's like the game that he had against the Bucks, he's not having as a rookie. And it is just, it is straight up terrifying to think about what he's going to do and how dominant he's going to be when he is like 28 or 29 years old, when his brain, because like his body is his body and whatever, like he's still, he creates space with his footwork and it doesn't even need to be super fast or anything like that. But like as his brain gets even smarter, which is what happens when you age in the NBA, it's just going to be a horror show. Like there's just no defending this person. And whenever he makes a step back three that is like lightly contested or hard or heavily contested, and it goes in, it's just like if this shot goes in more consistently, he's like the best player ever. Like he's on another level.
No, man, he's absolutely ridiculous, and he can take, you know, hyperbolic overreactions and just turn them into just like statements of fact. Like I saw so many people on Twitter being like, Luka's going to be an MVP in the next 3 years. Luka's going to win a title by the time he's age 25. And it's like, usually when people do that off of a guy's like best game of his career when he's 21, it's like, okay, calm down. Like it was the people like saying Gary Trent Jr., you know, perennial all-star potential based off of six games in the bubble, right? And that's when you're like, okay, slow down.
Great take. I love that take, by
the way. TJ Warren, is he better than Jordan? You know, people love to go like that direction on social media, mm-hmm. just, you know, completely go off the rails. With the Luka stuff, it's like MVP by 25, very plausible. MVP next year would not surprise me. Title.
I want to bet on it. No, I want to bet on him winning MVP next year. I swear to God. Like, I think that he should be the favorite. I don't. Like, why not? Why wouldn't he be the favorite?
Well, I think we could get you a Gambler's Anonymous helpline there, Michael. You got a little too excited there at the idea of being able to throw your entire life savings at Luka, but it would be a completely reasonable bet. What about this Harden comparison, though, right? Because I think that, you know, there's a lot of Harden haters out there. I imagine our guy Brandon emailing in is one of them. And Luka is the, you know, fresh new kid on the block, right? He hasn't had the chance to, quote unquote, flop in the playoffs. He's never even taken a team to the playoffs before. He doesn't have Harden's resume, as the Rockets bloggers were very keen to point out. That beautiful between the legs pass that Luka made is something that's like routine for James Harden, right? So routine that there's like a 3-minute highlight clip of him just doing it over and over and over against, you know, very high level defenses to all sorts of different guys on the roll. I think those are fair points being made by the Harden defenders. Right now, Luka or Harden, who would you pick to build your team around solely for trying to win a bubble title, and why?
Harden in 2 seconds without even really having to think about it. Harden's just better. Like I everything I said about Luka is like, my astonishment is, a lot of it is based on his age and his trajectory and what he will accomplish in his career. I think he's amazing now for sure. Harden's just better. Like if statistically, in terms of value, like all the value metrics, on off metrics really favor Harden. You know, their usage is the exact same this season, which is pretty funny. And Harden's true shooting is just notably better. He's just a more impactful basketball player at this point, and not to mention the defensive end, which is where a lot of Harden gets a lot of criticism. But Luka doesn't get like any criticism for his defense. And there was actually one writer who I don't even want to mention on the pod, but he gave Luka a vote for the all-defensive team, which like I just... my mind is melting. But Harden has been, you know, playing humongous minutes, a part of some of the better defenses that the NBA has even seen in the last 5 years. So, like, it's not even really a question for me. And yeah, I think Luka, in terms of value, is kind of a victim of his own circumstance where Dallas, like, their bench units are just always great. And even if you just look at this season, when Luka is not on the floor, like Dallas is perfectly fine. When Harden sits, the Rockets are like plus 0.01 points per 100 possessions or something. And when he plays, they're plus six. So, and that's with Russell Westbrook on the team, and they stagger minutes. So I just think Harden's more valuable. He's more skilled. He is underappreciated for sure. And my praise for Luka is, I don't mean to like temper it too much because he's incredible and I meant everything that I said, but it is just even more magical just because of his age, whereas Harden's been doing this for years. So we're used to it by now.
Yeah, I mean, look, 21-year-old Luka is definitely better than 21-year-old Harden. So the fact that 21-year-old Luka is forcing a conversation or a debate with current Harden says a lot. And I agree with you. Current Harden deserves the attention and the recognition. He's done more. He's earned it. He's been had a great season. I actually think he's more trustworthy in a playoff format, even though some people like to harp on that. Harden's had tons of big-time playoff performances. You know, he's a well-oiled machine, better two-way player like you're describing. I'm with you on all that stuff. At the same time, who do I want to play with? I want to play with Luka. I don't know if it's the magic of that smile, Michael. I don't know if it's the joy for the game. I don't know if it's the dolphin headers of the basketball where he's, you know, just, you know, bouncing that basketball on his forehead over and over like a dolphin. But it looks like an awful lot of fun to be a member of the Dallas Mavericks. That's all I'm saying. And I don't know if I would say the same thing about the Rockets. Actually, I do know. I would not say that about the Rockets. Okay. It doesn't seem like it's been super fun the last 3 or 4 years. And, you know, ultimately, like, I want to win. So I think I would want to sign up for the Rockets for the bubble because that would maximize my chances of winning. But if I'm tying my next, you know, if I'm a free agent and I'm tying my next 3 or 4 years to this thing, I'm hopping aboard the Luka train immediately.
You're moving the goalposts on me during your answer. But I just want to say there was a play that I want to point out at the end of that Bucks game where I thought Luka and KP were going to go at it because KP, I don't know if you noticed this watching live, but KP was, you know, they ran a high pick and roll, drew the switch. I think KP had like Wes Matthews on him or something at the high post, and he's just screaming for the ball. And Luka has his own mismatch because I forget who was on him, but it was KP's man. So, and Luka had it like going and he could not be stopped. And so you would think in this situation, KP would like space the floor, like float out to the corner or somewhere, elbow extended. And instead, he's just screaming for the ball. And Luka kind of is like being super nice and passive and gives it to him. And KP bricks a turnaround jumper from the elbow. And I thought that it was like with a minute left in a one possession game. And I thought that was a really interesting play. I don't even know how to like draw any conclusions about that, but I just wanted to point it out really quickly.
Well, so that's what I'm saying. It'd be more fun to play with Luka because even if you're going to throw a game away, he's going to at least give you the opportunity to do it. I mean, I kid. I just think that, I mean, look, it is the new flavor, right? And these teams that get on joyrides, the joyride never lasts forever, right? You can maximize like basically a 2-year joyride before people start to get sick of each other, you know, tensions start to brew, this guy's got too many shots or whatever else. But But the Mavericks right now are in that like joyride stage. And I have a feeling that like they're going to be able to just continue to find people who want to play with Luka because he makes their life so easier. He's going to get guys paid, you know, just like a Chris Paul or even a Harden has gotten guys paid in the past as well. And the joy stuff is infectious and it's very real. I mean, this guy comes out with a giant smile on his face before every game and he keeps it like that, you know, the whole way. It was so interesting watching him interact with Giannis before the tip-off. Luka bounds over like this, you know, puppy with a giant smile on his face, like wanting to like, you know, dap up and shake Giannis's hand. And Giannis is already going into his routine where he's got like the kill look in his eye and he's about to go run around and, you know, stare down the stanchion and everything else. And, you know, Giannis gave him a polite nod, but that was pretty much it. It was like, I'm about business. And it's just different styles, you know, different personalities between guys. But I do think having your best player carry himself like that and be so happy to play, I think it matters a lot. And I think that, you know, it's going to carry them well, and we shouldn't overlook that when we're talking about things like leadership potential or you know, just like pecking order issues for Dallas like down the road. I think there was a tendency for even players like Dirk in the past to kind of be questioned on that stuff because they're European, right? Or because maybe, you know, English isn't their first language or whatever other reasons people want to come up with. I think that Luka's leadership potential is actually super duper sky high because he keeps everyone invested, right? He's able to set you up for success, but he also just has that, you know, that personality you want to be around.
Yeah. Could I ask you a question real quick, Ben? So
that,
we know
that actually is a question. So yes, you can, and you can ask me another.
All right, Hassan Whiteside. We know who the Mavericks are going to play in the first round. In all likelihood, it's going to be the Clippers. Not certain, but that's what's most likely. Clippers are, I think, you know, the smart person's opinion is that the Clippers are the best team and the Clippers will win the championship. What percentage are you giving the Mavericks to upset the Clippers in the bubble?
15, 10, somewhere in there. Does that 15? Feel too low? 15?
Stunning. Yeah. You're usually a very conservative person, so I was expecting like 3% out of you. So 15, I'm kind of blown away.
Well, the Clippers just have not been that consistent top-end team here, and they've had so many guys in and out. That's probably what's influencing it more than anything. I also think that there's a chance Dallas is the third-best team in the West, you know? I mean, to me, it's like them or Houston. Houston probably creates more matchup issues like directly for teams, but Dallas is, to me, they're better than Utah. They're better than Denver in terms of like, you know, just playoff threat, like right now in this particular moment, not in a vacuum, not anything to do with like the regular season, is Dallas is a problem. Like they really are. Their offense is consistently putting up huge numbers and Luke is on a different planet. So I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from. I would still take the Clippers like heavily. But the Clippers have not had a smooth run here, you know, of the top three teams, you know, them, Lakers, and Bucks. I mean, all three of those teams actually have kind of new and deeper questions maybe than I expected coming out of these regular season games. But I think there's some level of vulnerability there.
I'm just really happy for the chaos, I gotta say. And real quick before we move on, I called you Hassan Whiteside. I realized that that's going to make no sense to anybody. I called you Hassan Whiteside because years ago I walked up to him and asked him if I could ask him a question, and he said, "You just did," and then he walked away.
Brilliant. Well, at least I gave you a second follow-up, Michael. That's nice of me.
Yeah.
What percentage would you put on it? You know, now that you're the one asking the questions, maybe you should answer them. What percentage chance would you give Dallas to beat the Clippers?
I just think Dallas's defense is really bad, so, and I think that their primary advantage against most teams is their bench and when their stars sit, and that's going to be not an advantage in the playoffs, particularly against a really deep team, assuming that the Clippers are at full strength, like the Clippers. So I would actually put it at like 6 or 7%, to be honest with you.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Not super bullish. I like that. All right. Let's shift gears here. We mentioned it a little bit earlier. Speaking of the Clippers, they got into a little back and forth with the Portland Trailblazers on Saturday. Lillard missed two clutch free throws in the closing seconds of that game. Patrick Beverley was just hooting and hollering on the sideline. I tweeted his initial comment, which was a sarcastic dollar time and tapping his wrist when Lillard missed his first free throw. after Lillard missed the second one, Beverly collapsed in hysterics with Marcus Morris Jr., started yelling out Dame time. Then he waved Lillard off the court. I believe Paul George got in on that as well. Afterwards, Lillard was not pleased at all. Basically said, of course those guys are upset. I've sent Patrick Beverly home in 2014 from the playoffs. I sent Paul George home in 2019 from the playoffs. He said that just shows you how much they're hurt by that in the past. I mean, it was getting very personal. Then they exchanged shots on Instagram with Damian Lillard calling Paul George out for constantly changing teams. Paul George then going to his Instagram story to let everyone know that he's had six major surgeries and his entire career would be different without those. You know, really existential arguments on both sides. So I'm curious, Michael, who won this trash talk back and forth? Damian Lillard, Paul George, Patrick Beverley, and then did Lillard's 51 points the very next night, did that seal it in his favor, or how do you view that?
Damian Lillard is undefeated, in my opinion. He cannot lose. He is the people's champion, regardless of what happens on the court. He's the most relatable, genuine, honest, authentic superstar in the NBA that I can even really remember, to be honest with you. And I love everything about him. He's so cool. I was shocked when he missed the free throws. I was not shocked by Patrick Beverley or Marcus Morris doing what they did. I loved his response because he's exactly right. Like, those guys know, like, those guys were shocked that I missed those free throws because I make every clutch shot. They know my most clutch shots. They were the victims of them. So it just gave him an opportunity to remind everyone that he's like a total winner and a boss. And to go at him on Instagram then and let him call Paul George out for, I think the phrase was he's running away from the grind, which was just like, I loved it. I loved it so much. I love Dame. I really, really, really hope that the Blazers get into the playoffs.
We'll get back to the playoff question in a second, but I want to just tie off the entire back and forth with one final quote that wasn't really directed at the Clippers specifically, but it was more of a general comment. Lillard was asked, you know, does he like clutch moments or the stress? You know, he had a big comeback against Philly to win that game. And he goes, I enjoy those games mentally because you can see people start to break down and have lapses. You get to the point where only a few people will push through. I like to take advantage. I know I'm going to be there the whole time. And as somebody replied on Twitter, John Wick flow. Like, that's kind of what he was going with there, where, I mean, it was just really kind of a sadistic viewpoint of just watching people crumble around him as he's trying to, you know, make it through to the finish line. I just love the competitiveness, like you're saying. And they needed it. I mean, they needed all 51 of those points, nine in the final 3 minutes, to kind of keep them afloat. And I think that was the big back and forth, is that Lillard was so upset about all of this, not because Beverly was mocking him or even their past history. He was upset because he missed the free throws, right? And he was mad at himself and he couldn't believe it. He was almost kind of shocked. And to have those guys try to, score points, I think at that moment, you know, really wounded his pride. I mean, he was genuinely upset on Saturday night when he was making those comments. You know, just being in the room there, it was like, oh boy, this guy's pissed. Like, I don't know if he's gonna break a television monitor. It wasn't kind of like that kind of anger, but it was sort of like he's taking out a notepad and writing people's names down, and then, you know, who knows what's gonna happen 6 months from now.
He was steaming.
Yeah, very like Michael Corleone Godfather anger there. But we got a question from Rob in BC. He says, I've been listening to you for a while now and I love the pod and the podcast. Love it when people say that, Michael. As I was listening to you guys the other day talk about the Lakers possibly exiting the playoffs early, there was one scenario that I was surprised you didn't mention. It might be even juicier than getting knocked out of the second round by the Houston Rockets. What do you guys think about Portland getting the 8th seed and taking the Lakers out in round one? Call me crazy, but based on how the two teams look right now, I can see this potentially happening. Michael, you know, you've been the number one Lakers hater on the internet the last week. Are you ready to triple down and take the Blazers over the Lakers in the first round?
I sincerely believe that the Portland Trail Blazers could beat the Los Angeles Lakers in the first round. Yes.
Stop there. The word could is doing too much work. We need to tighten that up.
I will say,
Can I get a will beat the Los Angeles Lakers?
I can't give a will until I know that Portland's in the playoff picture, which is why I didn't mention them last time, because it's just like I don't know who they're going to play in the first round. I don't want to get too crazy and lose my entire credibility off my Rockets pick, so I'm not going to go there yet. But I just look at that matchup and I'm kind of like, I understand that LeBron, like, I guess fundamentally what I see is that the Blazers can play all these different types of lineups. They have a breadth of talent. They can go big. They can go super small, as they did against the Sixers with ease. They played Melo at the five, and it wasn't a problem. They have the best offense in the bubble. They have the best point guard by far, I think, in the bubble. And the Lakers, like, they're super one-dimensional. They would probably have the two best players in that series. But then it's just like this severe drop-off. And particularly matched up against the Blazers, it's like, who is guarding Damian Lillard? Who is guarding CJ? You have this fascinating Melo versus LeBron thing, which is just like, I wonder how Melo will approach all of that. Because Melo not only is, of course, friends with LeBron and has only matched up with him once in the playoffs in his career, but the Lakers had an opportunity to technically sign Melo for a while, and they didn't. So, like, I just think there's an overflow of storylines. There's an overflow of problems, I think, from the Lakers' side, because they're going to need – their defense is fine, like, sure. They're going to need to score to beat a team like the Portland Trail Blazers with how Portland is playing. And – I don't know. I think it's not crazy to say that Portland can win that series.
So if Portland goes up 2-1 in that series, are you suggesting Adam Silver is going to show up in Orlando and actually force Melo to join the Lakers, like mid-series, just to make sure to keep them afloat? So here's the deal. I think that I agree with a lot of the points you're making. However, Portland's defense is really, really rough. I mean, yeah. You know, and in theory, they can play big and small, but like pretty much no matter what five they put on the court, they can't stop anybody. And so I would still take LeBron over Lillard as an individual threat. I don't necessarily trust his supporting cast, but like the formula for beating LeBron in the playoffs has been have basically two elite perimeter defenders and have a really reliable rim protector behind them. And then basically that's how you can drastically limit what he does over the course of a series. Otherwise, he will find a way to beat you. That's sort of been the game plan. And Portland checks none of those boxes, right? Like, they have none of it. They're not even getting started on that homework assignment. So that part really makes me nervous on their behalf. Now, at the same time, through five games of the bubble, Gary Trent Jr. had almost as many three-pointers as the entire Lakers team through five games. That is a big problem, right? I mean, that is sort of the, you know, the ultimate like 8-1 seed. How are they going to pull this off? It is a team that's a much, much better 3-point shooting just randomly stays hot for four games, right? And there's just, you can't make up the math. I mean, that's sort of the great equalizer in this kind of a scenario. The matchups on the perimeter drastically favor the Blazers. You can't really use an Anthony Davis or a LeBron on either one of their guards, right? So that doesn't really help you.
I think they will in crunch time, though, just like thinking way far ahead. Like LeBron, like I just think LeBron is going to want that task on one of those guys at least. And
well, maybe you could use LeBron on CJ, but I don't think you could use either one of those guys as a regular defender on Dame. I don't think that's going to end very well.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think the question of who would guard LeBron in that series is a hilarious one for sure. And I can just imagine the Lakers offense, just every possession being a LeBron post up, a double team, a kick out for three, or LeBron just putting his head down, you know, 2-9-ing the help defender, trying to get to the basket, drawing a foul. That's going to be just all that they do. And you don't really have a way to stop that necessarily, except just hoping that LeBron eventually wears down because he's 35 years old. But I think that that series would actually be like super competitive, and I really hope we get it.
It could be pretty interesting. I guess I'm picturing a lot of exasperated Yusuf Nurkic fouling out like midway through the second quarter. But I would say going the other direction, like I'm pretty sure KCP is like central casting for having a Damian Lillard three-pointer shot and hit over the top of him, you know, to be like, you know, placed alongside the Paul Georges and and I guess Chandler Parsons of the world. So you do have that kind of going for the Lakers on that side. But I would still take the Lakers here, but it's way more interesting than I thought it would be. And it's also possible we don't get it because all it takes is a little slip up here down the stretch and Portland's eliminated. So we'll track that going forward the rest of the week. Michael, before we're done here, though, I do think we need to give a little bit of an obituary to these Pelicans because we got a couple questions in here. First one's from Don. He says, I'm a first-time writer and long-time listener from Montreal. The NBA bubble has been really good in terms of return since we have seen some great team and individual performances, but there's one team that has been a real disappointment, the Pelicans. The Pelicans are a disgrace. So much hype going on coming into the NBA bubble. And for them to be able to try to make it to the playoffs, only for them to come up short again and again. Their latest effort in a must-win game against the Spurs was atrocious. This team was supposed to be a great fit between veteran and young talent, and most importantly, a generational talent in Zion. Peter wrote in before that game was even over to say, I'm annoyed that the NBA keeps giving the Pelicans primetime TV spots. The only NBA game I got to watch today was a boring blowout with the Spurs up on the Pelicans by 17 points at the half. Everything else is relegated to League Pass and NBA TV. What a waste of a chance to get a Sunday audience excited about the NBA restart. The Pelicans look sloppy and Zion looks out of shape. So we got some heaters. I got to say, Michael, my natural inclination is to defend Zion on these kinds of attacks. I think the listeners were speaking facts only. I think it was pretty pathetic, their outing on Sunday. They came out before the game half-hearted during pregame warmups. They played half-hearted defense throughout the entire first half. They made a little bit of a push, largely thanks to J.J. Redick and a few flashes from Zion. Their hearts were not in it. To me, the entire theme of the weekend, and I wrote about this in my newsletter, was who actually wants to be in the bubble? Who wants to sign up for another 2 weeks, right? And who's ready to check out? And that was actually one thing we got right, you know, previously, you know, going back a month or two, this idea of checkout time, you know, people being like, eh, you know, I don't really want to hang out longer than I have to in Orlando. I'm fine to go home and hang out with my family instead. That's exactly what happened with the Pelicans. And every single person on that team basically is implicated with the possible exception of J.J. Redick. Those guys were ready to rock and roll out of Orlando. And their explanations afterwards made no sense. I mean, Alvin Gentry said, there's no explanation. I told him it was a game seven. They weren't ready to go. They're basically never ready to go. So I think that kind of points to the coach. And then with Zion, he looked heavy, as the emailer mentioned. He never really consistently sustained top energy. He didn't play the big minutes that he was capable of holding down in March. And then ultimately, he was a minus a lot of the time he was on the court. Just, you know, four out of the five games, I think he was a minus. You know, he had one really nice showing, and that was about it. So I'm with these guys. I mean, look, they're young. It's a weird circumstance. There's all sorts of extenuating circumstances and situations you could bring up. But ultimately, like, that's a lot of excuses, right? Everybody's facing the same stuff, and this was the team that broke and folded first before many other teams did.
Yeah, it's one of the things that we talked about ad nauseum was experience and youth and just getting into the bubble, how that would impact things. And I think back to their first game on opening night, which was this loss against the Jazz that they totally blew. And I don't think they really ever mentally recovered from something like that. And you can tell who on that team is like a pro's pro, like J.J. Redick, who competed his butt off on Sunday afternoon against the Spurs. I just don't think that, you know, they probably had this mentality like, you know, every game is a borderline must win for us. And this is a winnable game. And they're up the whole time. They drop it. And then it's just like, okay, well, that's it. I guess, like, might as well just go home. I mean, guys like Lonzo Ball, just complete no-show. I forget if I've even mentioned him since we started analyzing this team since the restart, but, like, he was so bad.
He was getting his lunch money stolen out of his pocket, dribbling the ball up the court. I mean, it was just lackadaisical. And, you know, he showed a little heart on Twitter, retweeting Bleacher Report, kind of mocking his stats and being like, yeah, make sure you post him next year. How about show up in the bubble? How about that? Like, don't get into a Twitter argument over, you know, over your poor stats. Just own your play. And these guys just didn't want to play for each other, bottom line. And I think that they were probably thrown off by Zion exiting the bubble and then coming back. I imagine that kind of changed the entire tenor of this trip for them, because your biggest personality and kind of the face of the organization and everything is just suddenly not there. And so that's kind of outside that team's control. But they did not respond to that adversity well. They played poor defense along the way. And I think that I've got questions about a guy like Ingram. Does he make his teammates better? You know? He has a lot of nice individual one-on-one play. He can get a shot. He can get the right type of shots now. He makes good decisions. He's a tough one-on-one cover. But a lot of what he's doing, it's my turn, your turn stuff. The ball goes to him and starts to pound a lot. You have a lot of other guys on that team just standing around watching. It's not great. And, you know, he doesn't really bring it defensively, you know, from an effort or an impact standpoint either. At least he didn't here in Orlando. So, you know, if we're talking like glasses half full versus glasses half empty right now, like almost every individual Pelican, like my glass is pretty darn empty.
Yeah, I'm not going to crap on my guy, Brandon Ingram. I thought he was fine, I guess, you know, shot the ball pretty well.
Well, don't you want a guy like in that situation, though? Zion is out for undisclosed medical reasons, right? So it's like, look, we're down here in the bubble. We're investing a month together. Everybody hop on my back. I was an all-star this year. I carried us to 13 straight losses when Zion was out. Let's go and do it again, right? Like, you know, I'm being a little bit facetious, but that's what you want to see in that situation, right? You need to rally around somebody. They had nobody to rally around, you know? And they just, they went out there and were flat. They mailed in multiple games, and then they're going home, and I think they're glad to be going home, right? I think if there was some sort of a twist where they had to stay another 2 weeks, I think they might have guys just walk right off the campus.
No, I mean, all that is very fair, and I'm just being biased because I love Brandon Ingram. I think that it was also just, as you pointed out, very difficult to adjust constantly to like the unpredictability of Zion's availability and how many minutes he's going to play. And, you know, having a guy in and out of the rotation with these short stints and everything, that's just really difficult to adjust to. And, you know, they call plays for Zion, and in that Spurs game to try to get him going, like, he just, it wasn't there. And so I guess like my primary takeaways are that Zion, I don't even know what number you put on it. Like, was he like 65%? Not even, like, just a total non-factor on the glass, which is one of the biggest parts of his game, particularly the offensive glass. Just like the energy was not there. And then the other thing is, like, what do you do with Gentry? For him to say that it was a game seven yesterday, and for his team to be like, whatever, this is not a game seven, you're an idiot. I don't know where you go from there. I feel for Alvin Gentry, because I think that before the shutdown, he was giving the New Orleans Pelicans this really smart identity of speed, and he was accentuating a lot of his players' strengths. And, you know, Zion was really important, and Zion really wasn't available, and that's a tough thing to come back from if you're a head coach.
It's super tough. I mean, my first inclination would be is that it's time for a new voice, because they weren't listening, or like, he wasn't getting through. But there are a lot of crazy circumstances here. I could see them trying to give him one more year, or at least the start of a year, to kind of make a better case for himself. I don't see a natural like a pivot or alternative in that particular situation. It's hard to know what direction they would want to go.
So Woj reported over the weekend that if they let Gentry go, who has one more year on his contract, Ty Lue and Jason Kidd would be strong candidates for the position. What are your thoughts on those two?
I mean, I could kind of see Ty Lue maybe. I mean, we've been over the Jason Kidd stuff previously, so I don't know if we have to go back down that route. You know, those are the kind of the high profile names right now. And there's obviously a connection there with Ty Lue and David Griffin, so I could see that kind of making some sense. You know, he's a younger guy, energetic. I do think that guys listen to him and buy in. He's commanded respect of superstar-level players. I mean, ultimately, what you're describing about Zion's impact on his teammates, the word is disruptive. And it's not him being a disruptive person. It's just the inconsistency with his health and availability has a disruptive impact – on the whole team, and they have to sort that out if they're going to go anywhere, right? I mean, that's priority number one. And so to me, when you're saying, like, what do you have to do to make the Pelicans into the team that they were supposed to be, to make them worthy of the hype, to make them worthy of putting on the ABC afternoon game so that we don't get these emails from guys complaining about being forced to watch them? You've got to get Zion completely bought in. You've got to get him in shape and to stay in shape, period, right? And that has to come from the coach. And again, I'm looking at whatever their system is right now. There is responsibility that falls on Zion, 100%. He cannot be in the kind of condition that he was in, you know, after a four-month layoff. And there, again, the health stuff is tricky. There's really no way around that. But ultimately, he had to be better than he was for them to make any success. And so I think that's the next coach's you know, main challenge. Can Ty Lue do that? I would think so. You know, he's handled some challenging personalities before, you know, Kyrie Irving and J.R. Smith and others. So I wouldn't be opposed to that. I guess if my choice was Ty Lue or Gentry, the more I'm thinking about it, I would go with Ty Lue.
Yeah, I think that for Gentry, the difficulty there is, yeah, you want to be super hard on Zion about his conditioning, assuming that that was an issue that he could have controlled over the break. But at the same time, you need, like, he was a holdover from the previous regime, right? So even though he has a prior relationship with David Griffin, like, if Zion were to go to Griff and say, hey, like, Alvin Gentry's yelling at me too much, like, goodbye, Alvin Gentry, because that's just how it works. And so if you're Ty Lue, I think you come in with a little bit more, like, A, credibility, because you've won the title as a head coach. You've dealt with personalities like LeBron, and you would probably, you know, you're handpicked by David Griffin. So I think that he would be a little bit more comfortable pushing Zion and not worrying about the blowback that could occur.
I would hope so, and I hope that's what happens, because we did not get to see Zion anywhere close to who he was in March, and it was the biggest disappointment for me so far of the bubble, and there was not really anything a close second. All right, we're going to close on a lighter, happier note, Michael. We got an email from Kyle. He writes, "What a strange time to be alive. July was definitely the best month of the pandemic for my family. The NBA is back, and my wife heroically delivered our second child. I pushed hard for the name Golliver Michael, but she pushed harder during the labor, so we agreed to go with her idea, Niccolo Timothy. Sorry, guys. Now I am finally back to my favorite pastime, watching last night's NBA games bleary-eyed at 2:30 a.m. while I try to get the baby to go back to sleep." So, Michael, how do you feel about being snubbed here in favor of Jokic and, I assume, Tim Duncan is where he's going with that nickname? Was this an epic disaster for Kyle? I mean, obviously, congrats on the child, Kyle. Good job. I'm really happy for you and your family. But did he blow it with his name?
I mean, if I'm feeling snubbed, the number one thing is that Golliver is before Michael. Like, it's a no-brainer to have Michael before Golliver, right? So I think you would even admit that. So
I wouldn't have named the child Golliver, I'll tell you that. I really don't like my last name. It's kind of always haunted me. I feel like it's a typo, you know? It's not great. So I wouldn't have named the kid after it, but I don't know. I mean, you don't want your kid to grow up to be a weirdo. Name him Michael. Who knows?
I agree. Yeah, Michael's a great name. You can't go wrong. That said, you know, Niccolo Timothy is also a wonderful name, and congratulations on getting to stay up at you know, watching NBA games at 2:30 a.m. bleary-eyed. I'm not jealous of that, but congratulations all the same.
It does seem like this kid's going to have super high basketball IQ. If he's named after Jokic and Duncan, and he, like, basically from birth is watching games at 2:30 in the morning with his dad, I feel like this kid, Hall of Fame trajectory. I don't know if I want to say he's the next Luka, but I would say, Kyle, get that basketball and treat it like you're another appendage for your son. Just make sure he's always got it around. Make sure he's holding it. He's, you know, just touching it 24/7. Who knows? Maybe we're going to be able to come back on this show, Michael, in 20 years, and we'll be talking about the number one pick in the 2040 draft, a kid who should have been named after us, but wasn't. All right, guys, that's the end of another episode of Open Floor. Guys, check us out on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Michael is on Instagram and Twitter at Michael Villas and Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben Dog Oliver. On Twitter at Ben Golver. Be sure to check out my Washington Post newsletter. You can find it on my Twitter page. The link is in my bio. Go ahead and give it a click. Sign up. It's free every single Monday. All right, Michael, until later this week when we're going to double back with a whole bunch of questions that people emailed us at openfloormail@gmail.com. openfloormail@gmail.com. I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.